Welcome to the Lighter Side of the Dark Side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio and also every podcast catcher, Spotify, iTunes, Apple, wherever you're listening to us. It's the Dark Mark Show. I am Dark Mark, the goth comedian, back in L.A. and Los Feliz in my humble abode and my pumpkin patch. And as always, here's my co-host, everybody's favorite. Well, maybe after this show, you won't be everybody's favorite horror writer, Nicole.
Oh. Good evening, guys.
So far, you're my favorite, but we have another horror writer that's on the show today. So he may win over the Hearts of the Dark Mark Show audience. Who knows? He's got a fascinating story that includes all sorts of things, thrash metal, recovery, everything. And we're going to get all into it. He's actually just come out with a new book, Black River Lantern, which I look forward to reading. I haven't had a chance yet. I wish I would have taken it to the plane in Florida last week, but I think I might have scared the other passengers. It's Alex Grass.
Yay!
Hey. Hi, Alex.
Mark, Nicole, how you guys doing?
We're doing great. Glad to have you on. I've kind of seen the periphery of your story, which is fascinating, and we're going to get really into it and talk about your books and everything else about you. Before we do, though, it's late at night, and this is at Alex's suggestion to tape in the middle of the night. So I need to get my energy up, and the way I do it, I miss these guys when I was in Florida. Raise energy drinks. These are the best. Look at that, Alex. R-A-Z-E. This is the South Beach flavor. Tastes like a pina colada. It's delicious. They have other great flavors like Baja Lime. They have sour gummy worms, which are surprisingly good. All sorts of things. They're the best tasting energy drink. And the best part is zero calories, zero carbs, zero crash.
Nice.
That's delicious. Do what I did. You can get these at GNCs and the gyms, but don't pay full price. Get 15% off a case with the link that you'll find in all podcast catchers and on our YouTube. And Raise energy drinks. I love them.
Yay. Anyway,
go ahead, Nicole.
I just said yay.
Yay. We love Raise energy drinks. I got to be honest. I like this flavor. This is not Nicole's favorite flavor, but the Baja Lime she loves.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
Just check out all the flavors and get whatever you want. I'm going to get sour gummy worms next, and I'll make sure that you try that because that's really
good. I can't wait. Yay. Anyway,
and we have another sponsor, and I see you vaping, Alex. I think you might be interested a little later, but maybe not. I don't know. I know you're in recovery, so possibly not. Anyway, Alex, you've got a very, very interesting story. Now, you grew up in Philly, is that right?
So I was born in central Pennsylvania. I was born in Harrisburg. And we moved around a lot. So my old man was in the retail business. So we moved probably between 12 to 15 times by the time I was 17. So before I lived in Philly, we lived in Herzliya Pituah, which is a place in Israel. And then after that, we moved, or maybe it was before, we lived in Carmel, which is right outside of Indianapolis.
Right.
And then by the time I was 9, we settled in Philadelphia, and that's where I mostly grew up.
Okay, but, so like me, you were always, and I don't know, Nicole, if you had this situation, you were in Colorado most of your childhood. I was always the new kid in town. My parents, we drove across country, and we were in different places almost every year for a while.
I was in foster care, so I moved a lot. I moved every 6 to 8 months.
So you were in different schools like almost every year?
All the time, yeah. Yeah, every year.
So you know what that's like, Alex.
Yeah, well, not foster care, but I do know what it's like to move. I imagine Nicole's resettling was probably a little more difficult than mine.
Yeah, mine too.
Based on what I saw in the movie Shazam with Billy.
I think Shazam was the nice version of it. I mean, Nicole, was there ever a foster family that nice like the Shazam family?
My last foster family, which is the person I consider my mother, the Grasso family.
Okay, so there are magic Shazam families everywhere. Anyway,
I will say this. That was family number 17.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Man.
I'm glad you finally found them after all that time.
Amen to that.
Me too.
Now, what was it like living in Israel? I mean, how old were you then?
So the first time I lived there, I was real young. I was like 5 or 6 years old. And like so many countries, after the fall of the wall, you know, it was like sort of flooded with Russian kids. And also it wasn't like quite developed yet. So, you know, it was, it's a scrappy place. You know what I mean? Like one time I remember we were visiting.
Israel's a scrappy place.
Yeah, Israel's a scrappy. I don't know if you've caught this from the headlines.
Yes, yeah. A little scrappiness going on.
A scrappy place, yeah. So like my mom tells this this story, and I remember this. We were down in Eilat, which is sort of like their resort town, all the way down at the south. And I had like eaten some shawarma, which depending on where you get it can be great or can be like totally toxic. And I was affected by the latter. And so I had to go real bad. And there was like nowhere around. And we went into this restaurant and my mom's like, can my son use the toilet? And the guy's like, no, absolutely not. He didn't even wait to ask if we could buy something. He was just like, no. I think he just looked at me and he was like, that kid, my toilet, no way. You know?
Well, I have to be honest, you're a grown person. If you went to my house, I would say no, but that's just me. I don't know. You look like you could do some damage. But I was gonna ask, are you Jewish? I would assume so, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Except you can't be buried in the Jewish cemetery now.
Yeah. Well, you know, they say that. You know, the line in the Torah is you shouldn't mark your body, mutilations or tattoos like the barbarians. But the thing is like if you're in Israel, there's only state-owned cemeteries. So, right. Like, I don't think they have an option to not bury you. It's interesting though. That is the first thing that people say always. I suppose I invite it. You know.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was just. By the way, people don't know what we're talking about, and why would you? You're covered with tattoos.
Yeah. Well, I mean, relative.
You're wearing a tank top on, showing that hot body of yours to us too.
That's right. That's
I know.
Right.
I've got a boner. I don't know about you, Nicole.
I got tattoos.
I know you got tattoos. I've got a boner. You got tattoos. So, but you settled in Philly when you were in junior high.
Yeah. So I settled in Philadelphia after we were in Israel. And my old man for a while, he worked, he owned a motorcycle shop, sort of like a wholesale place.
Okay.
And that was just about like the greatest thing ever for me. Cause I would go in and I'd work there during the summers. And, you know, they would give me, yeah, thank you, man. They would give me the job of polishing all the chrome, you know?
Yeah.
And they made it out like it was like a real special privilege, you know, like not everybody gets to polish the pipes and the mufflers, the carburetors, but we have chosen you, Alex, you, our grand polisher. I really fell for it. And only later did I realize it was like, the dudes who worked at the shop when my old man wasn't around, they wanted me to do their job.
Right.
Very clever.
Right. When you're a kid, it's the greatest job in the world. And then when you you grow up, you're like, oh, that's the shit job nobody wants to do.
That's manual labor.
Well, yeah. I mean, the motorcycle shop explains the tattoos. But when I was hanging out with my dad and we were working on his motorcycle or working on his car, I was always the guy that held the light.
Yeah.
Held the flashlight, and I never could do that right.
Oh my god!
I held the flashlight like a girl. It just—I never got the light where it's supposed to be. Too, it was always like,
"How do you hold give me that?" And you go back like in the house. Girl.
I was gonna say, wouldn't girls be able to hold it more steady?
Actually, probably. I'm making a joke, obviously, but no, I never got the light where he wanted it, and it's like, and he when he's fixing something, he's doing something. He's not the most verbal guy, so. He's not exactly really guiding you, but anyway, so those days are over. He can hold his own light. So what was it like growing up in Philly?
Yeah, it was great. I loved it. you know,
from Israel to Philly,
from Israel to Philadelphia. Yeah. You know, I went to,
you got the cheesesteak. So that binded things up for a while. So you weren't using the bathroom as much.
No, we were talking about this the other day because I got brothers who have, like, it's weird. You know, we're a family that we're from central Pennsylvania and we didn't live around other Jews. So we like, I say we've got like a little bit of the central Pennsylvania hillbilly thing going on. Mm-hmm. And all my brothers, they're all like me. They're all huge, you know, real big boys.
Right.
And for the listeners that can't see me, it's a combination of muscle and fat, you know, in varying degrees.
That's what I'd say too. That's there's some muscle. No. You're a big stocky guy, and yeah, it's and now, you know, your picture is very sharp. You look really cute in that, and you've shaved all your hair off your head and your face, so you got like kind of a bit of a kingpin thing sort of.
Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take
going
it.
On. Yeah.
My
Michael Chiklis sort of thing going on.
Dude, The Shield's my jam.
I love the Shield, yeah.
Yeah. We used to watch that show, and when there was the scene where Chiklis was interviewing the child molester, and they were trying to find where the girl was, and he was beating him with the phone book, and my dad's sitting there. My dad's a TV talker, so like every hit of the phone book, he's like, yeah, that's how you do it. That's how you fucking do it. And yeah. I was just in my cup at the time. I'm like, how would you know how you would interrogate a child molester? But I suppose,
how would you know to use the phone book? Yeah.
Yeah. But I suppose, you know, it wouldn't leave a bruise, right?
Right.
That's the theory. Although the one time I watched The Shield with my dad, I was like, hey, you love this show. And it was a show where like Chiklis got shot like twice and he's in the hospital.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, no, I got to see my kids. I got to pretend I'm unhurt. And my dad's like, what is this shit? I'm like, trust me, it's usually good. He's like, oh, he's Mr. Hero. He's got to show his kids that he's not hurt. I'm like, so he didn't like it, but I showed him the wrong episode. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But so you're saying you were kind of like a hillbilly Jew in Philadelphia.
Yeah. So it was a strange mix because like, you know, I had a very privileged upbringing, but at the same time, we never changed the stuff we did. You know, my old man had some great success in business. And then, you know, he was after working in wholesale motorcycles, motorcycle parts and customization, he was in trading cards. So he was the CEO of Fleer Trading Cards. I don't know if you remember that company.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And and you know, while it lasted, it was amazing. You know, we used to go to like every single sports game, and my younger brother Sam, he still lives in Israel, but he had sort of like a Svengali like ability to hypnotize the players that he met. So there's this thing where he was at like the Hilton or this hotel in downtown Philadelphia, and kids were playing with Kobe Bryant playing video games,
right?
And everyone got like about 30 seconds, 45 seconds, as you could imagine. And my brother sits down with Kobe Bryant and he starts talking with him. Mm-hmm. And like every time someone comes to pull him away, and my dad was like, really didn't want him to be there extra time, you know, because no special privilege, but although special privilege, but every time they came to pull you away, Kobe was like, no, hold on. We're going. We got a game. There was another time with my brother Sam. So we were in the north of Israel. This is one of the times we weren't living there, but we go back to visit often.
Right.
And we were with this guy. His name was General F.E.A. Tom. And my dad was friends with him. And he was the minister of, I think, transportation at the time. So we're riding up in the north of Israel. And the north of Israel is abutted by, you know, Lebanon. So there's a border, and you know, it's sort of like, it can be, depending on the time, a precarious area. And so everyone's real sensitive, because I think at the time Hezbollah had fired some rockets into the north of Israel. And F.E.A. Tom's surrounded by these, like his security apparatus. And these guys do not smile and they don't talk, right? and we go to this sort of like Mizrahi restaurant, which is basically like hummus and baba ganoush and all that stuff they bring out in small right. plates like tapas. And we're sitting there the whole night. And then towards the end of the night, we know F.E.A. Tom notices, oh, where's my fucking bodyguard? Where is he? You know? And we walk into the other room, and Sam, who's like all of 8 or 9 years old, is showing the security guard how to make like origami fucking birds. And he's, I don't know how he does it, but like this guy's
still not hypnotizing people, or did that go away when he grew up?
Well, I would say he punches way above his weight in terms of, you know, who he married. So I suppose right. he did the ultimate hypnosis.
gotta have him teach me that.
Yeah, marrying up is the ultimate hypnosis, you know.
Did you marry up?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Big time.
So you know how to hypnotize women.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I like to say mine's sort of like more garden variety psychological manipulation, you know.
Oh, okay, you don't want to do that. Now, when you were a kid, what was the best Halloween costume you had when you were a kid?
Oh my God. For years, my mom did homemade Halloween costumes.
Right.
It was the worst, you know?
Yeah.
Like she made tiger masks. They were like covered in patchy oblong swaths of fucking felt and like wire cleaners coming out the nose. So it looked real big, like the Cowardly Lion, you know?
Right.
Like it definitely wasn't a menacing lion. It was much more like, you know,
it's a cute lion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the best costume I ever had. I dressed up like a disgruntled accountant once at like a real young age. I saw the movie Falling Down with Michael Douglas, you know? And I'm like, I want to be him for Halloween. No one really got it, though.
That's great, though.
Yeah,
maybe you should have had a rocket launcher on your shoulder, and then they would have got it.
Yeah, for sure. You know what? In that movie, he works at a defense company, but he doesn't know how to use a rocket launcher. Is that are we calling that inconsistent?
I don't know if everybody who works for a defense company knows the ins and outs of a rocket launcher, but he is the accountant after all.
Yeah, he is the accountant.
I know you grew up in Israel, so rocket launchers are second nature to you, but.
Oh my God. My brother called me once when they were sending rockets in State Road, and he's just sitting there on the fucking balcony smoking a cigar, watching it happen. And I'm like, man, this is just like, it reminded me of the scene in Predator where Arnold sees, Carl, I think it's Carl Weathers. Mm-hmm. Dylan, you son of a bitch.
Right. It's gotta be scary though.
Yeah.
As a kid, bombs going off all around you. And
well, I guess it is, but then also you're a kid, so you just, you know.
Hey, that's cool. It's a bomb.
Yeah.
So were you in the Israeli military?
No.
Okay. I know a lot of people have to be in the military. I thought it was like required.
If you stayed in Israel, you would have to.
Yeah. And three of my brothers served. But by the time I was at the age, I actually just moved back. Let me see. So I lived in Israel. And when I was around 18, 19, I moved back to America. And then what was I doing? Oh, I was, I was in a metal band and I was boxing.
I was going to get to the metal band. I didn't know about boxing. We'll get to that. But
okay.
It was called Shock Syndrome.
Yeah. It was so much fun.
What did you play in Shock Syndrome?
I started off as a guitarist, but then we found another guitarist who was, you know, better than me. So
you were the lead singer?
I was the growler, yeah.
Can you do a growl for us? I don't want to wake anybody up there, so if you can, it's fine.
Well, that's all right. The only person next to me is my brother. He's in the next room.
All right. Well, if you could do a growl, I'd love to hear a metal growl, a good one.
Okay. I'll try one. Hold on. Just like words. Yeah, let me just go into it.
Because mine is, I can do the Metallica growl. That's about it. Yeah. That's all I can do.
Hey, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me see. See, 5 minutes alone. Okay.
That's nice. Fucking metal. That is really metal.
Thank you. Thank you.
So how was it touring with Shock Syndrome? I imagine that now who are your influences? I would imagine
So the drummer in the band basically taught me. So I was into like the basic stuff, like, you know, like Metallica, Ozzy, all that stuff that you can go
Slayer and all that.
Yeah, like at Sam Goody when it still existed, you know, and they would just have it in the front, right, like the metal section. But I, you know, then I had a friend who taught me like a lot, you know, like I started getting like Gothenburg metal, like At the Gates. And then I've been listening to a lot of Amon Amarth lately. They're awesome. And I went to a Cannibal Corpse show, and then I talked to Alex Webster, their bassist, outside.
Okay.
For like 2 hours. And he was amazing. He gave me a shitload of bands, you know, like Six Feet Under. And let me think, what's the other one? The band that did Dechristianize. I wish I could remember. They're like, Vital Remains. Yeah, they were amazing. And then there were some local dudes. You know, Relapse Records is in Philadelphia. Relapse Records is like, you know, I think at one point they may have signed Napalm Death and, you know, like a lot of like known but unknown bands, you know.
Right. Known in the scene, but not known mainstream.
Right, yeah. Exactly. You know, and when you're a kid, you know, everything is, you know, you view things so narrowly. You have like such severe myopia. So it's like, you never heard of a Goat Whore? That's crazy.
Right.
Yes. No, well, you know, I mostly listen to like Michael Bublé. And, you know. But Goat Whore? You've never heard of Goat Whore?
Yeah. It's one of those, especially if you're in a metal band and you're hanging out with just metal people, you kind of get into that one, or if you're in a goth thing or whatever. But how far did you get? Did you ever open it up for anybody people would know?
Let me see. No, I don't think so.
Now, how scared were the mosh pits?
They were decent, you know. It wasn't, like, insane. It wasn't like, you know, when you go to Ozfest and you see, like, you know. When I used to go to Ozfest when I was a kid, it was, like, terrifying because there were, like, dudes that look like me now but no baby face. And they were, like, furiously, you know, the Bart and Lisa thing on The Simpsons where he's swinging his fist and he's like, not touching, not touching, not touching.
Right. I got to tell you, mosh pits are not what they used to be. I'm a little older than you, but I could stand in the middle of a mosh pit and not get hit. Yet if I stand outside of a mosh pit with a girlfriend, we'll get hit. Like everybody hits everybody else outside the mosh pit. They're not really hitting people in the mosh pit, which I don't get it.
Yeah.
Well, my girlfriend got smacked in the face by some monster at a ministry show. And yet I mean, you could stand in the middle of, there's like people standing in the middle like this. It's like, I don't get it.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe there's something that, maybe there's like sort of like a temporary tribal psychology that sets in where people are like, if you're not part of the mosh pit,
they're going to bring you in.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's not what I to me, it's like, okay, go ahead, do your thing. I'll be here. But no, nobody can. Yeah, nobody can respect that. But anyway,
I'm just going to stand out here. And if you would be so kind as to not wave your fist into my girlfriend's face, that would be
not knock her down and make her bleed. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
And then, you know, of course, when he came back around, I whipped it. I shoved him right to the ground. But, you know, so we got even. But anyway, so how long were you in the band?
Oh, let me see. About a year, and then we became another band called Neshama. And then I think there's a – and then what did I do? I moved out to Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I moved out to Pittsburgh. And no, I worked construction first. Sorry. I was doing demo for Center City Construction, which was just about the best job ever.
You realize this is all pretty horrifying. You're in a metal band, you're working construction, and you're boxing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I was a busy guy, and I was sort of like a manic guy. You know, like the next new thing, what's gonna make me feel the ultimate good, you know? Like, what's the supreme pleasure? Where can I get there? How do I calibrate my life so that everything feels amazing all the time?
You know? But you're a real man.
I thought that's what it was at the time. I mean, you know,
I have to be honest. I'm getting a little psychological profile here. You're really going out of your way not to be a Nebuchadnezzar Jew. Am I getting somewhere on this?
For sure. For sure. I do not like the Nebuchadnezzar Jews.
You know, the Woody Allen stereotype. How are you? Yeah, my name's Ivan. I'm Saul Rosenberg, you know that.
Yeah, exactly. No, I hate that shit.
Yeah.
I hate it. I hate it. I feel like, you know, my people, for better or worse, they're like any other people.
They're diverse.
Not to go weird on you, but are you a fire sign?
What's a fire sign?
They're a Taurus. Okay. So, all right. That means you go out there. The strong thing really helps with that. It was just your passion. Maybe wonder if you were a fire sign like an Aries, which is right before Taurus.
Yeah. I respect Aries. I like Aries.
Aries is the god of war,
right?
Yeah, he is the god of war, yeah.
There you go. I was talking about Amon Amarth. I believe one of their last albums was about the god of war, or maybe not. I don't know. I say it fits.
So how good a boxer were you?
I was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was all right. You know, I didn't really have to box. It was much more like the, I'm a man and I want people to see that I'm a man thing. So
I won the first.
No. I did smokers. Smokers are like when people show up in a gym and, you know, someone brings a case of beer and, you know, there may or may not be a physician on hand. And
these are very, very casual fights.
Yeah.
People are bringing brewskis and going in the ring and kind of, I don't even know. Sometimes there's rounds, sometimes there's not.
Mark, the first rule is you don't talk about it.
Touche. So when you were a kid, did you read R.L. Stein like Nicole did? And
yes, of course I did.
Yes. Woo. Yeah, I like R.L. Stein, Michael Crichton, Stephen King. Those are my three biggest influences.
I loved R.L. Stein. I read just about every book, you know, because they were always available. You remember you'd get those like little like catalogs at school? You like the checklist.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like you could never do that now. And you just like owe the librarian money, you know? And I would come home and be like, you know, I need like, I would always... Because I'm like a everything all the time, maximal, you know, fucking explode, you know, flooded engine, shit's going haywire sort of guy. So it's like, it's always got to be 200%. So I would buy like, you know, 20, 25 fucking books and I would go home and I would go to my mom first. And if my mom wasn't there, you know, I would go to my dad and be like, what the hell is this? What fucking 10-year-old spends $200, $300 on books? And the answer is one who becomes a horror writer.
Yeah. I literally started writing because I ran out of books to read.
Oh man. That's great. That's great. I love it. That's
well, cause back then, I mean, you're probably a little bit older than me, but back as circa 90s and in the 90s, there weren't that many horror writers. Like people talk about Anne Rice, but she doesn't really write horror in my opinion. And so I really love Stephen King, and we didn't have as many as we have now. And now there's like, I think everybody who grew up on Stephen King basically tried to become a horror writer.
Yeah. I mean, Stephen King, you know, the unseen influence of Stephen King is amazing. He shaped culture in a way that people aren't even aware. Like think about the clown subgenre of horror, like how that proliferated, you know, that's him. He did that. Although I granted I'm, clowns have probably been horrifying for a little while. I mean, if you really, if you really break it down, it's like, okay, it's a middle-aged man who probably doesn't have to have this job. He has another job, is going to come to your small child's birthday party, and he's going to dress up basically in drag with a silk Renaissance era puffy fucking costume with like huge fucking fluff buttons, and he's just going to be talking like a maniac the whole time. It's bizarre.
It is, yeah. It's very strange.
I should mention it. I'm glad you articulated that, because we had the guy who plays Art the Clown from Terrifier on last week, and we were just,
oh my god, I love him.
Yeah, David Howard Thornton. I'll tell him you said hi. And we were discussing why are clowns scary, and one of our guests last week, Hannah, had a story about when she was a kid, she didn't like the clown. She didn't think it was funny. And let's be honest, clowns aren't funny.
They aren't funny.
And he took her hands, like she was 5 years old. He took her hands and started like forcibly clapping. And she's like, that's why I'm scared of clowns. But everybody else is like, oh, yeah, I don't know. It's just weird looking.
I'm not afraid of them, but I don't think they're funny. And I don't think they add anything. Like, if the world didn't have clowns, I think it'd probably be fine. I don't think clowns are like important.
And of course, I used to go out with a clown, so that was
that's true. She was a cute clown, though. She was Clownalyn Monroe.
Yes.
Great. Nicole coming out with the controversial position. If there weren't clowns, the world would be okay.
Just saying, they don't do an important job.
Yeah, it's not quite like the engineer who builds bridges, you know?
Yeah.
Or the interventional radiologist or anything like
that. But Ringling Brothers never advertises the clowns.
What?
I said Ringling Brothers, Circus Vargas. The circuses never advertise. Ooh, come see the clowns. It's always, we got an elephant, we got lion tamer, we got trapeze artists. They're never like, oh, clowns too.
Well, did the clown get invented? Did it come from the gesture?
I don't really know the history. What I know about clowns is that I guess in the Renaissance and the run up to it, basically there was a pretty strong division, and you know, it comes from like the Greek plays, like I guess Aristophanes and other people. I think it was Aristophanes, but there's tragedy or there's comedy, you know? And there were always masks, like when they put on a play in Greece, they didn't dress as themselves, they were masked. And I suppose I would take a guess, and I have no idea if this is right, that there would be like a mask associated with comedy. And then just sort of like the regalia of the clown as we see it now, I associate with Renaissance era Italy. You see like uniforms that are similar. I mean, if you look at you know, like the first clowns before it was Americanized, because Ringling Brothers did, you know, like, or P.T. Barnum did what so many people in America did so well, is they, and I'm not putting a value judgment on this, but like they commercialized it and they sort of fine tuned it so that you could present it to the public writ large. But before that, it was a lot more like you were looking at, you know, like something you'd see at a carnival in 1600 something in Rome or Venice. That's my guess. I don't know. Got to ask Art.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't ask Clown anymore, but I will say that I don't know how he did it, because we've just been talking about total random shit. But
I have one more thing about clowns.
Oh, please go right ahead.
Have you ever read Biddley Little?
Which one?
Biddley Little. He's a horror author that Stephen King recommended, so I started reading him.
No. Hold on.
He has a book called The Ignored that I highly recommend. It's basically Fight Club with clowns.
Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah. It's called The Ignored because there's this whole group of men that basically society just starts ignoring to the point that they almost are invisible. And then when you're invisible, you have that kind of power, you can do anything.
Right.
Wow. That's quite an allegory for what's happening these days.
Yeah.
Who's going to make us invisible? And then we're going to be powerful again.
That's right. Podcasters, marginal horror writers, rise up and take what's yours.
Well, I was going to say, we've just been talking about random shit, but we stumbled onto your book, Black River Lantern, which takes place in the carnival.
Yeah.
Are there scary clowns in this book?
No, there are not. I think there's no clowns in the book, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I think. I know. There's no clowns.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote it. Let's see if you... hold on, my light went out. But yeah, you wrote
it. Does Mark have a ghost?
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah.
They're like, Mark's going to get real close to the screen. Oh my God, I think there's something in here.
There we go. Anyway, so.
I see giant red shoes.
Oh, no.
And you just hear this squeak in the darkness.
Yeah. Oh my God.
It's what even is that? Scarier. I'm back. Tell Nicole about the carnival at Black River Lantern.
Yes, please.
Okay, sure. So it's the Maravico's seasonal carnivale. And it's like basically this the idea is that this, I guess, I, you know, like subconsciously, I probably co-opted this from King. This is similar to Thinner. There's like a Romani group that comes over. You know, sometime in the late 19th century, and they set up this carnival, and the master of ceremonies is Papa Maravicos, and he's sort of like, you ever seen Men in Black, the scene where they go to find the alien, and they see like the weird dude in the East Village at the locksmith shop, and there's the dog there?
Yeah. Right?
So like the dude with the completely white skin and the stringy white hair, you know.
Okay.
I had that image in my mind the entire time. But so the carnival is it's basically run to conceal something more sinister, you know, something occultish. And Papa Maravicos is the inheritor of a long legacy of I wouldn't say it's magic, but it's sort of like access to extra dimensional energy. I was reading at the time a lot of Michio Kaku, who's like sort of a popularizer of theoretical physics, and his books are super accessible. So the idea is basically like, if you're a four-dimensional being, then you can't access anything that is above your four dimensions of, you know, spatial temporal perception. But the idea is basically like magic, as we conceive of it, I guess, is the subtext in this book. It's the ability for someone to reach those other places, enhance their perceptions, and then draw what's outside, what's hidden behind the curtain to affect change that we would see as supernatural here. And he does that. And he does that in horrifying ways.
Well, that's very interesting to me, because I believe in like a dimension on top of ours. There's the fourth dimension, then there's another dimension on top of ours. It's only energy. And I think that's where ghosts come from, if they're even ghosts. But I believe that when the soul dies, it returns to energy. And yeah. So when you do magic, you're just harnessing that extra energy and using it with your intentions, like be it through prayer or through crystals or through anything, you're just tapping into that extra energy. So I think I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's Nicole's saying basically a variation of what a lot of other people who are a lot smarter and more articulate and have thought about this a lot have said. So like Alan Moore, you know.
Mm-hmm. I love Alan Moore.
Yeah, he calls himself a ceremonial magician, but then if you actually listen to his lectures, he breaks it down as basically, it's like he's harnessing something, right? I don't want to like paraphrase or misquote him, because Alan Moore is very particular with words.
I've seen him misquoted. He does not, I don't know if he's going to be listening to the show, but yeah, he doesn't take well to that.
He doesn't cotton to that. But, you know, his ideas is, I think there would be similarities. And I want to say it's similar, but there'd be similarities. And if you want to get a look into his philosophy, you know, he is sort of like, there's elements of like hermetic philosophy, and I think perennial philosophy. But you can see that in his graphic novel Promethea. That's really good. So it's basically the heroine, the protagonist, is the goddess of art or creativity, and you know that's the way that she shapes the world around her. And there's another guy, his name's John Allen Greer, and he writes about it, and he has this great book. It's called The King in Orange, and it's basically about the use of magic, more like how we would understand it, as a series of like occult reckonings to influence world events. And so guys like that, I think, are closer to hitting the mark as far as like what we would call it. But as far as my book, you know, there's something that's like always been something exotic and maybe sinister about Eastern Europe, you know.
For sure.
And I understand that from reading a lot of the, I guess, the typical stuff that a Jewish kid from my background would read. You know, you read like some of the stories that are at the beginnings of Hasidism, you know, so like, when you're in New York, and I forget that not everybody sees these people. So, but when you're in New York, or if you see on TV, you see the guys who are still wearing basically the 18th century garb, like they're in the 1700s in Dubrovna or something. And they got like sort of like a double-breasted peak lapel, jacquard silk jacket and like a huge furry hat. The reason they dress like that, incidentally, is because that's how peasants in the countries they come from dress. There's nothing particularly Jewish about it. But the interesting thing is that the Baal Shem Tov, who is, it translates to the master of the good name, he was regarded as a magician. So like the guy who created that sect, and you see, he was regarded as a man who possessed magical powers. And before there was anything about his philosophy or you know, what he believed in his religion, there were tales about him. And this is sort of how it worked in Eastern Europe. I mean, there was like basically legends that were passed down. And one of them was where he battled a werewolf, you know, in the forest. And he used, I believe, music or an incantation to send him away. And then there's another one where, you know, a man was late for an incredibly important meeting, you know, and this is in Eastern Europe, so it's like life or death. The guy has to get there to get money, otherwise he can't feed his family and winter is coming, that sort of thing. And the Baal Shem Tov lays out a talis, which is like the ceremonial prayer shawl, and he crosses the river so the guy can make it. And then there's sort of just sort of like interesting common sense ones. Like this dude is trying to get home in time for the Sabbath, the weekend. And, you know, one of the things about, you know, very, very, very religious Jews is that like there's an adherence to the orthopraxy laws. So like the laws about how you live your life that, you know, like some people would say borders on psychotic, because it's definitely stringent. And so if the guy didn't get his horse home in time, he would basically have to leave it by the side of the road where brigands would take it, right? And so like, I think this is a Baal Shem Tov story. The fucking horse or the mule won't move. And Baal Shem Tov goes to the back and he says, "Can I use one of these carrots?" Yeah, and he just holds the carrot out in front of the fucking horse, like a foot or 2 feet away. And like the horse, you know, he wants some food, so he strives a little bit harder. So it's sort of like a combination of the supernatural, but also the very practical way that peasants lived in rural Eastern Europe hundreds of years ago.
Right.
And that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to bring like that sense of the mystical and the supernatural and the old world into a setting here in America, but in a location that is sort of like unrecognized. It's like Springfield in The Simpsons. You don't actually know where.
Typical American small town.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's what's interesting to me is I that these guys, they dress like peasants, but today they dress more formal than 98% of the people on the street. And that's interesting. And also, I'm guessing the rabbit out of the hat came from that dress.
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question. And I would love to know the source of the rabbit out of the hat, you know? Like, is it because, I'm here in Minsk. So, like, my thought after seeing what I saw yesterday, and I'll tell you in a minute, is, like, maybe because rabbits are so disposable. We went to the market here, me and my brother Harrison. Right. And it's like an outdoor market. Man, this is why people go to other countries, you know? So we saw there was just, like, a stack of dead rabbits. And they still had the furry feet on them, you know, like the lucky bunny hand
right
on the back of them. And my brother's like, why do you think they do that? And my first thing was like, well, maybe to prove it's like a rabbit and not a ferret, you know, or maybe the lucky bunny foot comes from there. It could be a number of things. I don't know. And so that's why the question about the rabbit out of the hat's interesting. You know?
Right. Now I want to get back to
vegetarian now, but rabbits taste really good.
My wife loves rabbits.
I've had rabbit stew while I was in New Orleans, and it was really good.
Yeah, that's New Orleans, though. They spice things up. But I've never had rabbit. I would imagine, but from based on your recommendation and Alex's wife's recommendation, I'll have it. But I want to get back to your biography for a second, because it's very interesting, very admirable in that you never got a high school diploma.
No, I got kicked out of school.
Now, how did you get kicked out? That's what I want to get to. How were you kicked out of school?
Well, my dad calls me like Eddie Haskell or Ferris Bueller. So, like, the setup for this is that, like, they were angling for me, you know?
Because you're a smartass.
Yeah, I was a smartass. I was a piece of shit. I was, like, I never got comeuppance, you know? And it sort of lasted that way. Like, my wife calls me the anti-Job, you know? So what happens, there's a senior project and you had to learn a completely new skill. And I said I was going to learn the violin, but I didn't really, you know, like the cross the T's and the dot the I's sort of minutia of day-to-day life, I was not good at, still am not good at. And so I never did what I had to do, which is go out and find, you know, a violin teacher. So I learned violin on my own. And then when it came time to submit, like, the proof, you know, I just, like, forged a letter from a teacher and wrote the name of, like, an old schoolmate of mine and didn't even let him know. And I put his number and I said, well, if they call him, he'll cover for me, which, you know, in retrospect, this is why, like, adults are always telling you shit when you're a kid, like, that won't work. And at the time when you're a kid, you're like, oh, what do they fucking know? You know, idiots, but they know something.
Because they tried and it didn't work for them.
Yeah, exactly. And that is basic shit. You know, if you're going to scheme, why don't you just go ahead and give some advance notice to your co-schemers?
Right. Well, what's admirable is you went back, you got your GED, and you got your college degree.
Yeah, that's right.
And you were in law school when you know, Mr. Always Land on Your Feet said, you know what? This isn't for me. I'm going to write horror books.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Let me tell you something. When I told that to my mom, holy shit.
How far along in law school were you?
Oh, I had, like, all I had to do was finish my last semester. Yeah, I know. My mom she blew a fucking gasket. She was going insane, man. You know, Jewish mom, family of lawyers. She's a lawyer. Her sister's a lawyer. Her dad was a law professor. You know, like, fucking half my cousins are lawyers. So that was scandal, man. That was scandal when it happened. But now my mom has, you know, all my books up on her shelf and she's like telling everybody I'm an author. So it worked out in the end.
A very similar thing happened to me. I quit college also to become a writer. And my aunt kept saying, when are you going to come back to school? And I'm like, I'm not coming back to school. And then as soon as I got published, she stopped asking that.
Yeah. Well, because I feel like I don't want to be cynical here, but, like, people want the best for you. But a lot of the time, because we're social beings, and this is, you know, kind of how we develop civilization, there is sort of like an element of, you know, presentation and gossip. And, you know, to say it in a bad way, it's sort of like there's always the keeping up with the Joneses thing. Mm-hmm. Various degrees. So I think probably what, you know, the cynic in me would say my mom probably didn't want to go to synagogue on Park Avenue and, you know, like tell everybody that her son just left law school and he had, you know, a semester left. Yeah.
But and your first book was Dreck?
No, actually Dreck was the most recent. Black River Lantern was the first one, but they all came out in the last year, so I don't really care.
Oh, okay. So what's Dreck about?
Dreck is it's funny. It falls within the ambit of dystopian literature, right? But I wrote it well before this like a recent flowering of that area, because after COVID, like I saw, I mean, Nicole, you probably noticed this, right? There's like all kinds of like pandemic and dystopia related stories now.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But like I wrote it way before. And the idea wasn't to focus on the dystopia. The idea was to focus on like a world that had experienced traumas and that was completely new, that had gone through something like an apocalypse. But that was like, even despite the lawlessness and like irredentism, it was sort of like the world was okay. It's like, what does it look like when it's rebuilt? And Dreck is the character who appears at the end of the, sorry, that's my old man. I'll just tell him. I'm busy. Thanks, Pops. Dreck's the character that appears at the end of the war, and he appears in the Levant, which is what we know as Syria. He appears through a portal, and it's just sort of, it coincides with these soldiers who had just finished fighting, sort of approaching this portal before Dreck comes out and being annihilated by, I guess, like what we were talking about, like the foreign energy. Where does this, you know, this strange energy, the supernaturalism come from? So they approach this door and they're annihilated by it. And immediately Dreck comes out afterwards. And so he's sort of like, he's the ultimate scapegoat. You know, he's evil. He's nasty. He's grotesque. He's like 8-9 feet tall. He has antlers. His face is sort of like, you know, it looks like he might have elephantitis. You know, he has three fingers on his hands.
Oh, Nicole's last boyfriend.
Was it that bad?
No, of course not. But no, but he's deformed and but he's so big that he rules the world, right? Or doesn't he?
Well, he's I guess he's slippery. No one can ever get a hold of him. They don't know, you know, where he comes and goes from. And every time, you know, there's something awful that happens, you know, they associate it with the grotesquery that is Dreck. I guess the one thing I can say without like spoiling it is that, you know, like most scapegoats, that's not completely right.
Okay. I got you. I just got a couple other questions and we'll let you go. We could talk all day. You'll be great. You're a fascinating guy. I could tell, I could see you and Nicole horror writer bonding as we're talking, but so I'm going to ask you this question, a couple questions. First off, your books have been described as Lovecraftian. How big of an influence was H.P. Lovecraft on?
That's a great question, because I didn't really read Lovecraft until I was in recovery, but I did read one of his stories when I was young, and it like had a profound influence in terms of scene setting. But he did something that was a lot more clever than what I do. He would like not describe exactly what the monster was, but you understood anyway, and you got it in your head. So you like, you read Lovecraft and you feel like you're looking at the monster.
Right.
But really, really what it is that he's using these descriptors and you're filling in from your mind. Right. So, you know, why does everybody imagine, you know, like why are the imagined tentacled beasts so similar? And like, it brings to the four questions about like, what's in our collective unconscious? You know, where does mythology come from? Why do we imagine certain things to be grotesque? You know, like, why are tentacles like gross and strange? Is it because they come from, you know, the deep, where things are more foreign than they are in space? You know, less is known about the area near the Mariana Trench than is known about the moon. But Lovecraft was able to do that. I understood that wrongly to mean that, you know, you needed to put the work in to describe, you know, the behemoth creatures, the frightening, mutilated, sort of monstrous, slimy things in the books. You know, like monsters needed their due. Right. But, you know.
But now, you know, you just need to describe them a little bit and our imagination will take over.
Yeah. Well, it's real easy. All you have to do is be H.P. Lovecraft. That's all.
Well, that helps. But Nicole, were you a fan of Lovecraft? And why do you think tentacles are so creepy and scary and gross?
Well, I think people just think tentacles are like, first off, it's something that can restrain you. And then it's also slimy. So it's like, it's kind of like you just don't want it touching you, which could even be just an inherent psychological thing of knowing it could grasp you. And that would be a problem.
Like Harvey Weinstein.
So it's very wet S&M.
Yes. It's something that just creeps you out, like spiders. Like people are afraid of spiders because the way they look unnatural. And tentacles are unnatural to humans because we're not, like jellyfish are also unnatural to us. The way they look, it's super creepy, but cool at the same time, in my opinion.
Yeah, what's frightening to me is things like jellyfish that have no cognition. You know, like the idea that there's like these incredibly complicated, there's this incredibly complicated biology out there, or like whole ecosystems without thought, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And jellyfish used to sting me all the time when I lived in Florida. Every time we go to the beach, nothing but jellyfish stings.
Yeah. Did you get peed on?
Yeah, my brother pissed on my leg. Mark, did that happen to you?
Your brother did not piss on my leg, no. But let me ask both of you one last question. How do you get the discipline to, because Black River Lantern is over 350 pages. Where do you, both of you, I'm going to ask both of you this, where do you get the discipline to sit down and write something like that? And how do you get past that, which for me happens every 30 pages, that writer's block?
In my case, it's simple. I just need to, like, I visualize it in my head and then I just get it all out. Like, I love the Hemingway quote, you just sit at a typewriter and bleed, because that's how it is for me. I have a whole cinematic universe in my head. And then I just, when it's time to write, I write it all. But I have big periods where I don't write. Like, it's good that I've been doing the blog for Charlie. Oh, speaking of, it also is probably a good time to do our sponsors.
Oh, we're going to do the sponsor. Yeah, go after this, talk about the sponsor.
After
and we'll
this,
get yeah. Alex's take on this.
But so the blogging for Charlie has forced me to have to do like homework again, like where I would force myself to write. I can force myself to write. Like I can choose to leave my apartment and go sit down at a bar and then just let it come out. So I just, it's Kevin Smith says he doesn't get writer's block. He gets writer's laze. That's what I have. I just sometimes don't feel like writing.
Do you just vomit it out on the page and then refine it later? Or
yeah. But I'm it's usually pretty concise vomit. Like when I write it by hand first. And then when I edit it, the first time I edit it is when I'm typing into the computer. So it's usually pretty solid because I've been thinking about it for a while. Like right now, please don't steal my idea. I want to write a vampire pretty woman. And so I've been kicking that idea around in my head. Not pretty woman as a vampire, but Richard Gere's character is a vampire. And then he picks up sort of a vampire, My Fair Lady type situation. But
that's a great idea.
They sit in my head until it's time for them to come out. And then it just comes out.
Now, were you having some Renegade CBD gummies when you brought that idea?
You know, I wasn't. But tonight we had a special event that I will be writing about in the blog for Charlie. And I took a couple of my Renegade CBD gummies beforehand. You can get Renegade CBD gummies too. Mark will tell you how.
Yes. And also, they have CBD bath products and Kush. So if you go to Renegade Kush, K-U-S-H, And that's Renegade with an A, R-E-N-A-G-A-D-E, Kush.com or RenegadeCBD.com. You can get the Kush or the CBD. They have white chocolate. They have gummies. And they also have, because Alex, you're in recovery, nothing wrong with taking a bath and CBD bath bombs. Very relaxing.
Very luxurious.
Very good. Very luxurious. So, but no gummies and no chocolate for Alex.
Not for me.
In recovery. But Alex, same question to you. How do you get the discipline and what happens or doesn't happen to you? What happens to me? Like 30 pages, I'm like, I'm on a roll and then it stops.
Remarkably similar to Nicole, actually. Long bursts. Like Black River Lantern, I wrote in a month. Drek, I wrote in a month. The next book that's coming out, it's called A Boy's Hammer. It's about 500 pages. I wrote in a month. And then just like a long time doing other stuff. But I definitely relate to the idea that like you have something in your head and you got to get it out. And if I feel like you don't get it out, Nicole, you say whether or not you feel the same way, like it itches the rest of the day and then you feel guilty.
Well, apparently I have nothing in my head. So, but Alex, I got to say, this has been a treat. You've been a great guest and we've had a great time. And if I could speak to Nicole, I think I can. We'd love to have you back.
Yeah, sure. I would love to.
Let us know when your next book comes out. We'll do some promotion for it.
Absolutely. Have your manager let me know when I'm putting it. And the next book is called again, what is it called?
A Boy's Hammer.
A Boy's Hammer. Let us know when A Boy's Hammer comes out. We'll have you back on. And we'll Zoom you with somebody interesting. And we'll do a whole thing. Maybe another horror writer. I'll just... Stay out of the way and let you guys talk writing. But tell everybody how they can get a hold of you, how they can get your books and all the books that you have for sale.
How do you get a hold of me? I guess the easiest way to would be like to send me a message on Goodreads. I don't have any social media. So I guess
you have,
yeah. I guess if you want to get a hold of me, you can send a message through like Amazon or Goodreads.
Or your website, blackriverlantern.com.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. I forgot that. There's a website, Black River Lantern. You can send an email there. And I'm pretty good about, like, getting in touch. I really like it when there's something about the books that, I guess, that moves people. Because I know what that's like for books to be, certain books to be so important. You know, to
any interesting fan interaction?
Any interesting fan interactions? I have a guy down in South Florida. He's a widower, and we started talking on Goodreads, and I sent him a copy of all my books, and then we got into a long conversation about like being mama's boys, and he was just the greatest guy. Yeah, and he's just like you know, just sort of like a sensitive, smart guy. And he's not really even into horror, but I don't know how he came across the first book, Black River Lantern. And he seems like a real stand-up, smart, quality person. Nicole, I'm sure you know from your background, Dark Mark, it seems like you've been around. That's hard to find.
Yeah.
We mama's boys have to stick together.
We mama's boys got to stick together. That's right.
Well, I think that's a great way to end the show. And Alex, good luck to you. Find your books on Goodreads, on Amazon, or even better yet, at your local bookstore if you have them, and order the books through them so that you get paid and they get paid. You know, support your independent bookstore and order Alex Grass's books.
Support your independent bookstore, or Jeff Bezos will take over everything. Which
Or order on Amazon if that's what you want. It's a free country. Anyway,
I fucking love Amazon Prime.
I would imagine most of your sales are on Amazon. But
Oh my god, it's probably only a couple dozen not on Amazon. Amazon's the best.
Right. Okay. Order it wherever you can.
A writer too. I'm indebted to it.
Yes. And Nicole, tell everybody where they're going to get a hold of you.
I'm also on Amazon, or you can order me at Barnes & Noble. I'm about to put out a poetry book in either December or January, so I'll be giving updates on that soon. You can find me as Nicole H6 on Facebook and Nicole Six Books on Instagram.
And I'm a goth comedian on all social media. We've had a great time, and I encourage everybody to read now. Reading is fundamental. Reading is good for you. Go over the reading rainbow and read Nicole Six and Alex Kress. And everybody, have a wonderfully creepy week. Bye.